And welcome back. Hour number three, and we get to talk to, as we do every week, I don't know how he continues to put out the amount of material he does, but he does. Mitchell Henderson is with us now, and we have, he's given me a title for tonight's program, Surviving My Life. Hello, Mitch. Welcome back. Let's find out what this is all about. Sounds very interesting.
Okay. Well, at the beginning of 2024, Jeff encouraged me to basically write my book, The Final Wars, How to Survive the Coming Civil War in America, World War III, and the Collapse of Civilization. His book is available at Amazon.
Yes. A Bible, it is a tech manual of survival in the days that are coming, for sure. You must have this book. It is a survival tool, of which there are none like it. Go ahead.
So, part of encouraged me to write this is to also reveal this information on his radio program. So, over the past year, I have basically, on the program, gone through the entire book, except for the first part, the introduction. And part of the introduction was about telling you in the book my experiences of how I come to know what I'm telling you, what I'm telling you about survival. So we're sort of at the end of 2024. I'm starting at the beginning. Okay, we've already got through the book, so I'm kind of starting at the beginning and giving you the information I should have given you in the introduction. So,
not necessarily. This is kind of a good way to circle back and point out the bedrock, where it came from, how it came about. That's fine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. So my book, I say that I'm going to discuss the coming final wars of civilization in mostly secular terms. Over 99% of us live and think in the secular world, even if we are religious. The secular world is daily becoming more polarized, and that is what will lead to civil war in America and spiral into World War III. This book is for the many, not for the few. To true people of faith, everything is clear and obvious. The final wars, the end times to them, is between the Antichrist and the Christ. Who is the Antichrist? All my life, there's been much speculation about this. I have seen everyone from Gorbachev to Osama bin Laden identified as the Antichrist. I prefer to just go to the source to identify what the Antichrist is. It seems to be talking about both a system and a type of man. The term Antichrist is defined by John in 1 John 2:22-23. And I'm quoting, "Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is Christ? He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father either. He who acknowledges the Son has the Father also." So this one verse describing what Antichrist is, I want everybody to realize that the statement in here, and this is important for those who follow the Revelation or the Apocalypse, okay? Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father either. So he who acknowledges the Son has the Father also. So I want you to look at this. What's going to cause World War III? Okay, what's going to cause it is the Middle East. Okay, the fight between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Okay, I want you to realize that the Muslim people do not acknowledge Christ. So they do not have the Son. So they do not have the Father. God is not on their side. Okay, the Jewish people and the Israelis, they do not believe that Jesus is the Christ. Okay, so God is not on their side either. God is not in Israel's side. God is not on the Jewish people's side. Okay, use common sense. God is on Christian side. Okay, that's all he's trying to say there in this one verse. In 1 John 2:22, you can look it up yourself. Okay, the two salient points are that an Antichrist does not believe that Jesus is the Christ. They do not see him as divine or the Son of God. The Antichrist does not know God, and God is not on his side. You can clearly see that it is obvious that many individuals, organizations, and governments qualify as an Antichrist. To be clear, it is the refusal to acknowledge Jesus Christ that defines this. An individual, organization, or government that does not acknowledge it or refuses to issue an opinion on it is an Antichrist. There is no neutrality. The choice is required. There is an individual Antichrist who will be the final world leader in Christian eschatology, and he or she should become apparent when the time comes. I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you the truth. When I attended the Military Intelligence Staff Officers course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, back in 1986, they told us that intelligence is a combat multiplier. The truth will help you win. They taught us that interpreting the enemy's intentions based on an American cultural point of view is not truth, but a delusion. Ideally, you want to interpret the intelligence about your enemy from their point of view. If you want to know what will make a nation go to war or launch a nuclear war, you must understand them from their point of view, not from what we think about them. Like it or not, I'm just going to tell you the truth. You will not be comfortable with it, but it is my intention is not to make you comfortable. It's to make you pay attention. Complacency gives your enemy the element of surprise. As a young armored cavalry officer in Southcom in the 1980s, I was very concerned with revolutionary guerrilla movements in Latin America. I read everything written by guerrilla leaders I could get my hands on. In the field in Latin America, I talked to many of the guerrillas firsthand in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Colombia, and Peru. I also talked to the local soldiers involved in counterinsurgency. I read a book by General Alberto Bayo called 150 Questions for a Guerrilla. He was the Spanish Legion officer that taught Castro and Che Guevara how to be a guerrilla. When Jeff Rentz asked me to speak about... Go ahead.
No, you go. Go ahead. That's interesting. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. When Jeff Rentz asked me to speak about how to survive the coming catastrophes, I thought General Bayo's method would be the best suited for radio. I'm not repeating what he said. I'm just using his method of discussion. I am going to describe the polarization in American society and present it to you like an intelligence estimate. Whether you are on the right or the left, you will not like what I'm going to say. But it's not my intention to cheer for either side, but to tell both sides what is likely going to happen. Intelligence is a combat multiplier only if it is accurate truth. When I say polarization, I'm talking about perceptions. It is perceptions that matter. So if the right or the left are offended by what I say, it only proves my point about polarization. Both sides think they are obviously correct and moral. This is, after all, what starts fights and feuding. To survive anything, you must understand accurately what your predicament is and respond appropriately. Do not panic. Always keep in mind that there will be time to panic later when everything has calmed down. You must not give
like
up
that.
No matter
That's
what.
That's good. Always time to panic. Don't worry about that. You're not going to lose that.
Don't panic when the thing's happening. Panic later. You must not give up no matter what. Never quit. If you don't quit, you will probably survive. Let me say that again. If you don't quit, you will probably survive. I had a friend and a neighbor in Belize named Joe Yancey. He was a Marine at the Battle of Chosin Reservoir during the Korean War. The 1st Marine Division situation was bleak, and the weather was a frozen wasteland. It seemed hopeless. It was a harsh, brutal, and miserable track under relentless pressure from the Chinese People's Volunteers. How did he survive? By focusing on putting one foot in front of the other until he finally made it to Hungnam and evacuated by sea. He didn't think about getting to Hungnam on the coast. He thought about what he had to do the next minute. He was alive to tell me about it because he did not quit. Okay, I will start
Very
by telling
good.
You
Very
what
good.
I personally learned about survival. Then I will give you an estimate of why we're headed towards the Civil War in America and World War III. My estimate will change as I get more information, and so should yours. What is important is that you're paying attention to the events going on around you and are connecting the dots. I will talk to you about how to think about preparation, because most of you will be in a city when the shit hits the fan and may still be there after the fall of civilization. I will address survival and fighting in the city. I would encourage you to not stay in the city if you can get out. I will address how to survive and fight in rural areas. At some point, there will probably be nuclear war. It is survivable, and I will give you the information that you need to know how to survive it. This information was put out on the Rents Radio Network on the Jeff Rents program in 2024. So that is the introduction. Okay.
Very good.
So,
all true. 100% true, as always.
Okay, so now I'm going to tell you my life lessons on survival. I'm going to discuss surviving in civilian situations, not military situations. In this book, I will describe infantry tactics so you will know them, but being infantry or cavalry in combat is not going to be like anything you do, because the infantry or cavalry trooper has an immense amount of support to do what he does that you will not have. You will not have field artillery support, air defense artillery support, tactical air support, communication support, or the logistics support that a soldier has. You will be more like a guerrilla fighter. You cannot afford to engage in pitched battles with an enemy. You must evade detection to survive. If you must fight, it must be hit-and-run tactics and avoiding any pitch battles. In other words, escaping your enemies. You need to preserve your supplies, your health, and your life. Unlike a guerrilla fighter, you are not engaged in a revolution to overthrow an economic or political system. Your objective is to survive, to preserve your life and the lives of those with you until the final wars of civilization burn themselves out. This will be no easy task. If there is a nuclear war, about 10% of Americans will die in the first hours of the war. Within a year, about 90% of Americans will be dead from lawlessness, famine, and disease that follows. As you can see, you need to preserve your energy and your supplies. You are not going to be a soldier. You are going to be a survivor. Most of your enemies will be other civilians, but you should be ready to deal with military forces or at least military-trained individuals. Victory for you is not enemies destroyed or territory captured. It is being alive when it is over. Okay? So
well said.
This is a mindset that you must have. Okay? You're trying to survive. You're not trying to prove anything to anybody. You're just trying to survive, you know? You're not going to be Rambo. You're going to be Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay? Although I realize he didn't survive. You're going to
fight.
Poor
guy. Okay. Where did he get set up? Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He was a patsy. So I've been surviving all my life. Survival is a way of thinking. When I was 7, we moved from Montana to Detroit, Michigan. We moved to East Village, north of downtown Detroit. Currently, it gets an F for crime and an F for health and safety. Its crime rate is 476% higher than the national average. You have 1 out of 8 chances to be a victim of a violent crime there. I had to fight almost every day, and I got mugged as a kid if I tried to go 1 block away to go to the store. It was hard to get to the store with any money. I had to learn to fight just by necessity. And keep in mind, I'm only like 7 and 8 years old. I'm not a big guy. I had to learn to fight just by necessity, by adapting to the reality of my environment. The fights were going to happen, and adults were not going to intervene. I did not have any special skills, and I was just an average-sized kid, so what I lacked in skill and strength, I made up for in viciousness. You may have to do that, too. I had to strike hard and fast with as much violence of action as possible and never pull my punches. I had to fight no matter what. So my opponent's size, skill, or even the number of them made no difference. I learned fast that when somebody attacked me, I should not merely defend myself, but viciously and violently attack them. Offense is the best defense. Attack, attack, attack was my sole focus. I did not think about avoiding pain. I only focused on inflicting pain. This is very much mindset. But you have to realize I was driven
into
it. There was no
Mitch,
other option.
How did you come to those realizations at seven? Who was your role model? Did you have one, or did this something that just intuitively came to you?
Well, I came from a family of Kentucky hillbillies from Bell County, Kentucky.
Oh, okay.
Real Americans. My grandfather was a moonshiner. My grandfather was both a deputy sheriff and the biggest outlaw in the county. Okay, so I came by it all honestly. And my father, my grandfather was murdered when my dad was five. My dad watched his murder. Okay, so and he was abandoned by his mother that very same day. So he was raised in an orphanage, and he had a rough life, and he had to fight for himself too. So that's why there was no intervention. I had to go out. Right. Okay. So, fortunately, I made a friend named Angelo. His dad was a made man in this really crime family. At first, he just told me practice fighting because he had more experience than me. Then he taught me how to shoplift, shake down vending machines, shortchange, pill tap, pickpocket, and food bill beat. He taught me how criminals think. We were too little to do strong-armed robberies, though. He was the same age, so we couldn't do that. I started running away from home when I was 14. At first, I usually just hitchhiked to New Orleans, Louisiana. But Angelo taught me made life easy. When I was 14, I ran away to New Orleans during Mardi Gras. I left Memphis with 50 cents. By the end of my first full day in New Orleans, I had taken a bath in a gas station restroom, had new clothes, new shoes, and $280 in my pocket. I was a street kid, but I was much better off than most street kids, and I was already street smart, thanks to Detroit, my little mafia friend. But this is survival in civilization. I also love to run away to the Ozarks, especially the White and Buffalo River areas in Arkansas, where I lived off the land by hunting and fishing. My family lived in the countryside outside of Memphis, Tennessee, so me and my buddies went hunting in the woods and cotton fields almost every day. When I was small, there were family members that told me that they were going to kill me. They had both the motive and the ability to carry their threats out. I was most vulnerable when I was sleeping. I would put a big atlas in my pillowcase above the pillow and sleep with it on top of me in case somebody tried to stab me in the night. I still sleep with a pillow covering my stomach. I would put a chair by the door with stuff on it so that if somebody opened the door, it would fall off and make noise. If things got tense, I would sleep under the bed or in the closet with the monsters because they were safer places.
When I 7 years old, Mitch? Still seven or eight?
Yep. Yeah. This started when I was like four and five. So this started early. When I ran away to New Orleans, I had to find a safe place to sleep. Away from the French Quarter, there were run-down industrial areas that had very scary-looking alleys. These are the places that they take people to kill them or dump their bodies because nobody in their right mind would go down these intimidating alleys. These were the same as the closets with monsters in them. This is where I could sleep in peace. I would just find a place out of sight and go to sleep. My survival mind developed early. And I want you to realize that this is also a realistic thing, okay? I'm not believing in myths. I'm looking at the reality. They take people to these places to kill them. That people are too scared to walk down them, so there's no crime in the alley. This is where they take the victims to finish them off or dump the body. So as long as I'm out of sight, I'll be safe there, right? I mean, I figured that out at 14.
Unreal. So, what, did you crawl into an empty building, find a shelter of some kind? It's pretty warm in the summer.
It just had to be out of sight, basically, that's all. Just so that nobody would see me, because, you know, I would be a witness if somebody saw me. So
I hope this gives all of you an idea, who are new to the program, perhaps, of the mind and the man behind this book, and why I say it is the most important survival document you can possibly get. So don't forget that The Final Wars, Mitchell Henderson, on Amazon. It's a gift of life, really. for people who don't know. And I'll tell you right now, very few of the people know anything in that book. Go ahead, Mitch.
Before I turned 18, I had four instances of people shooting at me to kill me. The first gunfight I was in was at 7 years old. We were at my aunt's house on a Sunday. She had a country store right next to her home. Some guys came up to get gas, and my aunt told them she was closed. In a very rude and mean manner as possible, they demanded that she open and started walking towards her. She pulled out a pistol and started shooting at them. They drove off but came back in a few moments, stopped in front of her house, and opened fire on her and her family. I was playing in the yard and took cover behind a telephone pole. My dad came by and threw me behind a rock wall and explained that bullets would go through the telephone pole. He told me not to look over the wall. If I wanted to look, I need to lay down behind the wall and peek my head out near the bottom of the wall quickly. I asked him for a gun. He smiled and said there were only enough guns for the big people. The shooting was fast and furious. It was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me so far in life. Finally, they drove off. There was a shattered glass from the car all over the road, and three fingers were laying in the road from one of our attackers. My dad knew what he was doing. He had been in four major landings in the Pacific War, Leyte, Mindoro, the Gulf of Lingayen in the Philippines, and Balikpapan in Borneo in the Dutch East Indies. He taught me about covering concealment and making myself into as small a target as possible to reduce my chances of getting shot. This was driven home to me at 7 years old. By 14, I was adjudicated a juvenile delinquent, convicted of being a felony offense. I ran a burglary crew and trafficked the goods that they stole. We would stay out all night getting into mischief for fun. One night, I was wondering why most people were afraid of being out at night. It seemed so peaceful to me. My buddies pointed out that it was us that people feared. It was after this that I started running away. So my parents sent me to the very lawless Log Mountain, Kentucky area where my father's family was from. I ran around with the bad guys. We partied on moonshine and got into all kinds of mischief because there was simply no law enforcement that would respond. These guys would get drunk and decide to kill somebody, anybody, just anyone that was available. Twice that was me, and I had to run under a hail of gunfire. The first time we were out drinking and they wanted to gut someone. I was the one they knew the least, so they decided to gut me. They had a K-bar knife, and they were just going to slice my belly open and let my intestines fall out. One guy grabbed my belt from behind. I quickly turned around facing him, and he lost his grip on the belt. The best time to escape anything is right when it is going to happen to you. He was drunk, after all. Then I sprinted across the road and got into some bushes in the drainage ditch. They ran over and started shooting into the ditch, but I was already running north in the ditch. When your attacker is armed with a knife or a gun, always put as much distance between yourself and your attacker as fast as possible. They drove by shooting into the ditch. I figured they would continue to do so, so I went in the trees up from the ditch and followed the crest of the hill home. They continued shooting down in the ditch for a while, but I was not there. The second time, we were up at Henderson Hall in Davisburg on the hillside drinking. There was a large group of guys. They decided to kill me for fun. A guy who was favorably disposed towards me warned me. I saw a group of them coming towards me, focused on me. Always pay attention to people that are paying attention to you. They are signaling their intentions. I ran down the hill zigzagging. They were about eight or nine guys shooting at me. Once I got far enough down the hill that I was out of sight, I ran perpendicular to the line of fire and got out of the beaten zone. Never stay in the beaten zone of gunfire, and do not let them see where you go because you do not want them to adjust fire to follow you. It was a long walk home through the bush, but it would have been foolish to go back to the road where they could find me. Once me and a buddy went up to try to talk to a couple of wild girls named BB and Bobo. We were sitting in a car talking to the girls. Their dad came out with a shotgun and opened fire on us with slugs and double-aught buckshot. The windshield exploded on us from the buckshot. This was an old-type windshield, so it shattered all over us. He kept pumping out lead as my buddy backed down the long driveway. When we got out to the two-lane blacktop, we were covered in blood. We stopped at a spring and washed the blood off. We did not get hit. It was just the shattered glass peppered our face and made it bleed so much that we expected grievous wounds. They were superficial ones. The lesson, duck when people are shooting at you, and do not try to date BB or Bobo. So,
wow.
When I was 17, me and a buddy flew up to Alaska to go hunting out in the wild all summer. We just had people drop us off in the middle of nowhere, and we started walking out into the wild. It was so beautiful, it was mind-blowing. I know we walked into areas that nobody had ever walked before. We lived entirely off of the land, but my buddy decided to work for the highway department to make good money, so I just headed out into the wild by myself. I carried a .30-06 caliber 1903 A3 Springfield bolt-action rifle. I usually got around to hitchhiking. Let me just say something here. If you're going to go to Alaska, someplace like that, where they have big bears and stuff, you need something like a .45-70 caliber rifle with more than one shot, okay? Because a .30-06 is not big enough for Alaska. Okay, that was a foolish choice. Okay, so I
used that was one quick thing, and I'm not in anywhere close to your experience, but I remember when those Springfield 30-06 rifles, they found a whole bunch of them in the 60s and 70s that were still packed in cosmoline, I guess, or something.
Oh, yes.
And this goes back to World War I time. And they were selling things on in magazine ads and all kinds of things. They're really a classic American rifle. But a pea shooter up there when you need something more like a cannon.
You need something with some knockdown power, okay.
Wow.
So I usually got around by hitchhiking. Hitchhiking in Alaska with a rifle was not unusual. You would have to be crazy to not have a rifle with you, but even crazier to wander off into the wild by yourself. At this time, they were building a road from Anchorage to Mount McKinley Park. I decided to go up it to find a good place to go out into the wild. It was getting off time for the highway workers when I arrived at a Bailey Bridge. This is a temporary steel bridge, okay? They put a chain across the bridge so nobody would use it. Roads must be inspected before people can use them. I planned on walking for several more hours before camping, but I decided to rest on the bridge and smoke a cigarette before heading out. Soon a car drove up. He saw me leaning on the bridge with a rifle slung over my shoulder and smoking a cigarette, so he naturally assumed I was a security guard. He offered me $20 if I would drop the chain. I did. I did not walk up the road. I had a change of plans and stayed all night charging people $20 to drop the chain. Let's just say I was a very corrupt security guard. Okay, I made about $300 that night. I headed out in the morning before anyone got wise to what I was doing. I could survive in the wild, and I could survive in the city. Having the foresight to see advantages when they arise is surviving. Once I was in the mountains south of Seward, Alaska, I was looking for something to kill and eat. I was walking on top of the hill when I saw some cute bear cubs. I started running immediately downhill. Bears run better uphill than downhill, especially in the snow. If you zigzag in the snow, the bear will lose its balance, but you can keep yours by grabbing vegetation to steady you. There was no point in shooting the bear, even with the .30-06 rifle, because she would maul me. The bear's goal was to protect its cubs, so she eventually broke off the attack to return to her cubs. If the bear had caught up with me, I would be dead because nobody knew I was up there, and nobody would be coming by, maybe not even for several years, if ever. As winter was coming on, I had to hitchhike back to Memphis. I turned 18 in Dawson Creek, British Columbia. The night before, I had to make a decision. Would I be a criminal or would I not? I considered the criminal career path and the retirement plan. I would have to spend time in jail, and the prospect of all that boredom did not appeal to me. There was no retirement plan. I would end up on the street as a bum, and I had already done that. I could do it, but it was in its own way boring. I decided not to be a criminal. In the long run, honest work was easier with a steadier income and a better prospect for a comfortable old age. Foresight is critical to survival. This is adjusting your strategy for dealing with life. My draft number was 11, so I knew I was going to go into the Army. I was a high school dropout. I was I was a high school dropout. I was trained as a chemical, biological, and radiological warfare staff specialist at Fort McClellan, Alabama. I was sent to Korea, where I was the radiological warfare staff specialist for a tactical nuclear field artillery unit. We had Honest John and Sergeant missiles to shoot at the North Koreans. I can still do many of the radiological warfare calculations in my head. I learned that you can most definitely survive nuclear warfare. That was my job, to know how and to advise the command staff. I learned to quit fearing nuclear warfare and how to deal with it. Fear and panic are your enemies. Never take counsel of your fears and realize that there will be plenty of time later to panic when it no longer matters. I spent two years in Asia. I went to Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, the Ryukyu Islands, Guam, Thailand, and Laos. They said join the Navy and see the world, but I did the same in the Army. In Thailand, there were mortar attacks at Nakhon Phnom Royal Thai Air Base, and in Laos, there was open warfare. When I got off of active duty in 1974, I went to British Honduras and bought a sailboat. I sailed around the Western Caribbean and lived off the land and the sea on little sand islands, little sand caves. It was a tropical paradise. Sometimes I would earn money by taking people out to the reefs to dive. Sometimes I would catch fish and sell them, and otherwise just hustle to do what I could to make a living. I got by just fine. One night there was a full moon out, so I decided to use the land breeze off the shore at night to sail north. A storm blew in and caught me outside the reef in open seas. The wind was furious and there was a driving rain. I could not see my hand in front of my face. I dropped my mainsails, threw out a sea anchor, and left only a jib up to drive me forward. South of Belize City, there is a key called Goff's Key. This is a key on Belize's barrier reef. I used to camp there for months and had the whole key to myself most of the time. This key is on the north side of English Key Channel. Years before, a big ship had run into the reef at Goff's Key and gouged a chunk of reef out of the seaward side. Huh. Normally, the front of the reef drops off precipitously into the sea, but here there was a little shelf in the front. This is where the storm threw my sailboat onto the reef. When my sailboat hit the reef, it threw me overboard. The waves pushed me back against my boat. The big waves were smashing my wooden boat against the reef. Once the boat broke up, the waves would smash me against the reef. It would be like being shot hydraulically through razor blades. I would be sliced into pieces small enough for the small fish to eat. But my feet could feel the rocks below me. I hooked my feet onto the rocks and pulled the boat off the reef. As the breakers washed over me, I would hold my breath, and as the swells came, I would catch my breath. I had to pay attention to my timing, or I would swallow a mouthful of seawater. I wrecked about 8 p.m. After an hour, I was completely exhausted. I only had 9 more hours to go till daylight. But by the end of the second hour, every muscle in my body hurt, and I was completely exhausted. There were now only 8 more hours to sunrise. By the third hour, it was very simple. If I quit what I was doing, if I quit paying attention to my timing, I would die without question. Now I just concentrated on catching the next breath of air. I thought about the next breath, not 8 more hours that I had to do this, just like Joe Yancey in Korea. Okay? Eventually, the storm passed and the high waves died down, but the waves were still breaking over me and the reef. When the sun came up, I could see a cut in the reef to my right. I swam, towing my boat, through the cut. I anchored my sailboat behind the reef and swam off to Goff's Key and passed out on the beach. I have no idea how long I slept, but I had a sunburn from hell when I woke up. These were the happiest days of my life.
All right, stop. So, I need a rest. Hold on. I got to... God, Jesus. That is harrowing. To put it mildly, there's a reason you're here. You knew that. There's a reason you lived your life the way you have. You know that, too. How big was that sailboat that you literally pulled?
It was a 21-foot sloop, a wooden sloop.
This is really astonishing. That's major motion picture stuff all the way. and then some.
The point to this story is that no matter how bad or miserable it is, no matter how much you cannot do it, just do it the next minute. Just don't quit. Okay, you're going to run in the coming days when the shit hits the fan, when civilization has collapsed, this is going to happen to you, and you have to not quit. You have to encourage the people around you to not quit also, okay? So, anyways, my sailboat was kind of wrecked, so I pulled onto the beach at Caribbean Trailer Court in Belize City. I had befriended the owner, a retired Belizean police sergeant named Joe Westby. I would watch the office for him while he ran errands, and he let me stay there for free. I sold my boat to an Australian guy, and Joe Westby bought my .30-30 rifle from me. Belize was British, so they would only allow an ex-police sergeant like Joe to buy it from me. I couldn't sell it to just anybody. There was a Dutch couple driving to Guatemala staying at the trailer park, but I still had a lot of things to sell out of my boat. There was a Protestant missionary staying also named Burton McDonald. He offered to buy all my stuff at my price if I would take a box of Bible tracts with me to pass out at my journey south. The tracts were in English, and I explained that I was going to lands where they spoke Spanish. He knew, but was willing to do the deal anyways. It was a box of 500 Bible tracts that he wished me to pass out. I do not know what it said inside, but the cover had a drawing of Jesus, and it was titled, Jesus Warns Earth-Shaking Events About to Take Place. Mm-hmm. We drove to the Tikal Ruins in the Petén Jungle of northern Guatemala. Every day, airplanes would fly in from Guatemala City and disgorge tourists from the U.S., Canada, and Europe. Since this was a place that I was going to encounter the highest concentration of English speakers, I decided to pass them all out at Tikal. These people were disgusted. Most threw them down or in the garbage, but everybody read the cover. That evening, they flew back to Guatemala City. When I was done, me and the Dutch couple hiked north on a trail to the ruins of Huachactún. That night, at 3 a.m., an 8.4 magnitude earthquake struck Guatemala, centered around Guatemala City. In less than 5 minutes, 23,000 people lost their lives and 76,000 were injured. Everything was trashed. Where I was, they had wood huts with tin roofs, and the tin roofs so violently and loudly that it woke everybody in the village up. They turned on the radio, and the bad news streamed in. I did not save a single soul for Christ. All I did was carry out my side of a business transaction. I did not enjoy passing out the tracts, but I made a deal, and I was going to keep it, even if the preacher never knew if I kept it or not. 5 years before this, I would have just thrown them in the nearest trash can, but I decided not to be a criminal and had to stick to it. Survival is about adapting, and adapting is about change. Guatemala was destroyed. They brought bodies out of the town to the town square so family could claim them. Dogs were munching on them. The smell was atrocious. Flies swarmed the dead bodies. Soon they would throw gas on the bodies to burn them. Bodies do not burn readily. All the bridges over the rivers collapsed. To ford the rivers, bulldozers would push dirt across the river. Then a few cars would drive over until the river washed too much of it away. Then they would start again. It was slow going. People that lived in the stone structures with pitch roofs seemed to survive, but flat roofs seemed to be death traps in the earthquake. It took us about 2 weeks to get 100 miles to cross into Honduras. There was no food and no clean water. There was no electricity. People were getting sick. We were far from the capital, so aid would not arrive anytime soon. Once into Honduras, we found a small store that had the most refreshing ice-cold beer that I have ever had in my life. The Honduran beer, ironically, was called Salvavidas, which means lifesavers. I parted ways with the Dutch couple at Copan Ruins in Honduras and hitchhiked through Honduras and Nicaragua to Costa Rica. I lived in Costa Rica for a year and took an intensive Spanish language course at a school that teaches Spanish to missionaries. These are always excellent courses, and they will take paying students. Survival is about making transactions with other people to get what you need. This is easier if you speak their language. Always complete the deal, even if you cannot be checked on. One thing always leads to another, and integrity is a critical part of the process. This event taught me how important integrity was, how important it was to complete a deal that you have made. Okay.
You know, Mitchell.
Yes.
There's something guiding you out of the ordinary here to have survived what you've survived, to have learned what you've learned, and we've only heard a little portion of it, I'm sure. Integrity, principles, morality, courage, never doubting yourself, understanding that to stand for a higher ideal, such as concluding a deal, making a deal, and holding up your end of it, those are universal truths. And I don't know how you made that decision not to go criminal and to go. I wouldn't have blamed you for going the other way after what you've been through. But this is the kind of material that's in the book, everyone. And this is what the man lived through to bring you this book many years later. So don't miss this opportunity. The Coming Wars, Mitchell Henderson, Amazon. It's a keeper. And it'll save your life in many, many ways, not just one. It may save your life several ways, such as integrity, morality, and principle. Well done. Wow.
Yeah, there's no advantage to being a rotten, dirty traitor, okay? I think that's part of the point here, okay? So when I returned the following year to the United States, I went into the National Guard in the field artillery, then to the regular Army to attend flight school at Fort Rucker, Alabama. I was at Fort Rucker for 7 months. Flight school for warrant officers was difficult and demanding.
Mm-hmm.
I crashed 2 helicopters in a row. The commandant asked me to give him one good reason to keep me in flight school. I told him, "Sir, if I crash just 3 more helicopters, I will be an enemy ace." He said that he was not amused, with a fat smile on his face. He was trying hard to keep from laughing.
I bet he was.
The next 2 years in the Army Marksmanship Training Unit at Fort Bliss, Texas. I participated in marksmanship matches, taking first place in the M60 light machine gun at Fort Bliss in 1977, then at the Forces Command matches at Fort Riley, Kansas in 1978. We ran ranges for the CID and counterintelligence agents. Their range days included a barbecue and beer, which is why they had us run their qualifications for them. We also taught weapons and microchip to classes to ROTC, but mostly we just went to the range and practiced shooting. I went to Central America in 1979 to get involved in the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua against the Marxists. Me and 2 ex-army.
What prompted you, Mitchell? Excuse me. What prompted you to go? What prompted you?
Well, because Marxism is evil. It's Satan's religion.
Great answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, and I was a cold warrior. I mean,
gotcha.
You know, it's what I did. I had no problem fighting against Marxism. So me and 2 ex-army compatriots hired a motorized longboat to take us down the San Juan River that forms a boundary between Costa Rica and Nicaragua to Barro, Colorado. We were going there to meet with some Misura guerrillas in Brooklyn Rivera's Mosquito Army. The Mosquito are the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua. This area is called the Mosquito Coast. The Mosquito generally speak English and are Protestant rather than Catholic. If you look at a map of Nicaragua's Caribbean coast, you will see cities named Greytown and Bluefields. The Mosquito were rebelling against the Marxist Sandinistas, and the CIA was funding them. When our boat pulled out of the Sarapiquí River into the San Juan, Sandinista troops took us prisoner at La Trinidad. They set us down, and before they asked a question, one of the Sandinistas kicked me in the mouth and knocked a tooth out. That tooth is still missing. They told us that we were under arrest for being Yankee spies. We had nothing in our possession that indicated anything about what we were doing. We had anticipated capture by the Sandinistas. The guy driving the boat was a Mosquito Indian, our contact to take us to the rebels. So they took him prisoner as well. None of us said anything at all. We did not talk among ourselves. Anything that you say to them or among yourselves will be twisted into evidence against you. This is good advice when you are arrested anywhere in the world. The likely trial would amount to just a summary execution. Since we had entered Nicaragua, we had not done anything yet. They locked us into a wood building with a dirt floor and fed us just one bowl of cold rice and beans a day. There's one bowl for all four of us. We had a liter soda bottle with water in it. Just one bottle for all four of us per day. After a few days, a Sandinista officer showed up. The guys who arrested us proudly proclaimed that they had arrested three Yankee spies. The officer asked them what they caught us doing. They looked dumbfounded and meekly said, well, they are gringos. The officer said, well, there are 250 million Americans, and they do not all work for the CIA. What made you think that they were spies? Once again, they said that we were gringos. Finally, the officer asked me, what are you doing here? I said, we hired this guy to take us in a boat down to the San Juan River to Barro, Colorado, to go fishing. Barro, Colorado was known for its great fishing, and known worldwide for its great fishing. We are tourists. He told them to let us go. We talked them into letting the Mosquito Indian go also so we could continue our trip downriver. It was a reasonable request, so the officer approved it. Never offer any information about anything if you are captured. You are always just a tourist. You are always just a tourist. Don't be a businessman because Marxists hate them, and they might think you are worth money. Don't be a journalist either because soldiers don't like them.
Right.
I returned to the United States and finished my bachelor's degree in geography at Memphis State University in just five semesters, graduating magna cum laude. Not bad for a high school dropout. I moved to Tampa, Florida. I wanted to go to college in Florida, so I needed a job for a year to qualify for resident tuition. I went to work at the Tampa Police Department. I was an honor graduate of my police academy class. Most of the other cops had trouble seeing me as a cop. I just did not like act like one. I think they gave me special assignments so that I would fail. The first time, my lieutenant called me in and gave me a special assignment. There was a rash of robberies outside the gay bars on Kennedy Boulevard. The robbers caught gay guys in their cars having sex or smoking joints, and they would rob them, severely beat them, and damage their cars. He wanted me to stop it. I was one cop in a Marx unit. What could I possibly do? They would not rob anyone while I was around, and there were numerous gay bars spread out over several miles. The lieutenant just said, you're a cop, you'll figure something out. Well, there's no way I could catch them in the act, so I had to focus on the victims. If I could deprive them of their victims, then the robberies would stop. Smoking marijuana was a crime, and having sex in your car in a public parking lot is a crime. So I started arresting the guys out in their cars. It takes too long to take them to booking, so I just gave them notices to appear. It was not a big deal. They would go to court and pay $200, but that was cheaper than the expense of getting robbed, hospital bills, and car damage. Soon the bouncers were outraged. They confronted me outside. I explained what I was doing and asked them to tell all their patrons that were leaving not to linger in the parking lot because there was a homophobic cop on the rampage. It's kind of funny, but they were more afraid of me than they were of the robbers. Back in the early 80s, gay people were not so out, and so many could not be outed by an arrest. But not by a robbery. A robbery wouldn't out them, but arrest would. They knew about the robbery problem. It was the gay bar owners that asked the mayor for assistance. I was the assistance they asked for. So the bouncers and their bar managers assisted me any way they could. It worked. After the first month, I could not find gay guys hanging out in their cars in the parking lot, and the robberies ceased. The lesson here was to be innovative and to make allies to accomplish the goal. It's misunderstanding the human terrain, okay? Also, just because the tax seems impossible, just do not give up on it.
You know, Mitch, you're giving cops a good name here. There couldn't have been any better police officers on the force than you. More fair-minded, more world-wise. I mean, your common sense is a bright light in a very dark, routine, rote kind of, I would think, environment for police. You must have been recognized or considered to be something very special on the force by those who have brains and eyes to see and ears to hear. You're doing it, you did it your own way. I get that. Wow. It's the Final Wars. Get this book, enjoy it, learn from it, and it may very well end up saving your life. I'm not kidding. This is an extraordinary accomplishment written by a man who has led an astonishing life. Thank you, my friend. That was really quite a ride, and there's much more to it. So take care, and happy 2025, and we'll see what happens. We'll walk through it together here, all of us. Thanks, Mitch.
Well, happy New Year's, everybody. Happy New Year's, and you know you probably got a year where you can get prepared, people.
There's still
get
time.
Prepared. Take this time.
What a blessing that
There's
is.
There's still a little bit of time.
Yeah, very very good, Mitch. You be well. We'll talk soon. Great job.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, that's it for tonight. Wow. Back with you tomorrow in 21 hours, New Year's Eve. Talk then.